Hey everybody. So before we get started, I just wanted to apologize. This is super delayed. We recorded a couple weeks ago. We've had a really incredible time recently organizing everybody to go out to Sacramento for the big YIMBY Action Day. And there's been a lot of stuff happening. So there'll be more podcasts coming relatively soon without such long delays. But I want to encourage everybody to become a YIMBY Action member. You'll get the newsletter. You'll get to stay up to date. And also, we're just starting to plan the YIMBY 2017 conference, which is going to be in Oakland this year. So if you go to YIMBY.town, that's YIMBY.town, YIMBY. Hopefully you know how to spell that by now. And get your tickets now. We've got early bird prices going. Also, if you're thinking about being a presenter or if you have something you want to share with the YIMBY community, there's a great place on there to fill out a form. We encourage business people and whatnot to sign on to support. Any extra donations you can make actually go to sponsor people so we can have a wider socioeconomic range coming out to the conference. So donations, a lot of that's going to go to getting people out there who wouldn't otherwise be able to attend. So please go to YIMBY.town and sign up now. So with that, I'm going to go back in time to a few weeks ago. Enjoy. All right, so the music comes in.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
Hi, welcome to Infill, where we discuss local San Francisco politics and policies with Team YIMBY. I'm Laura Clark of YIMBY Action.
Brian Hanlon of Carla.
Sam Moss with Mission Housing Development Corp.
Tim Colin with the Housing Action Coalition.
And today we have a couple of things. One is today we had the TAC, that's the Technical Advisory Committee, giving a report on the inclusionary zoning. And it's super wonky, but it'll be fun, I swear. And also our upcoming trip to Sacramento and how exciting that's going to be. And talking about some legislation that Brian helped write, which is super exciting. And also touching on that, Scott Wiener's SB 35, which we talked about previously, which I am going to be a special expert in Sacramento this coming Tuesday. So,
So are you going to be on a panel or something and speaking for
Okay, so
how's it going to work?
So there's four experts. So with good news, yeah. SB 35, Scott Wiener's bill to make buy right have a little bit more bite, especially in wealthy suburbs, is now on a fast track. So it's going to be getting through committees as part of a package of bills that are going to be faster. And so they normally this process would, you know, take place like 3 months from now. They're now getting four expert witnesses who come up and give, comment on how great the bill is. Experts speaking about different parts of why it's awesome. And so I'm going to be speaking, representing renters, YIMBY Party, housing activists. Nice. Yeah, it'll be really cool.
You're an expert.
I mean, you know, I talk a lot, so.
That's 90% of it.
Right? Yeah. Talk real good. so that'll be fun. Okay, so the TAC. So I sat through it. It was terrible.
So I'm glad that you sat through it. I confess to skipping the Planning Commission meeting today. I had intended to go, but it was so gorgeous today, and I haven't been on a bike ride in weeks. I worked through the weekend, and I was like, fuck it. I am going on a ride through the East Bay Hills. Like,
Brian! How could you skip the meeting about meetings about meetings?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Yeah.
informational session.
Yeah.
It was a very important meeting about how a group of people met to meet about a future meeting.
Yeah, so some of those folks already heard my take on the TAC strongly, I guess, firmly earlier. Let's talk a little bit about this for those of the listeners who don't know. So the Technical Advisory Committee was set up as part of Prop C, which, you know, established a 25% inclusionary rate for the city.
But we have to define things. So inclusionary zoning is the percentage required affordable on market rate housing. So this was moving it up from being about 12-ish percent, depending on a bunch of other stuff, to about 25%. and saying, okay, we're going to actually form a technical advisory committee that's then going to say, is this a terrible idea or not? And they basically kind of said, like, yes. And let's have some more terrible ideas.
Yeah, I mean, and the more terrible ideas are, I think, what's really important here. So the one good thing that Prop C did is it moved the inclusionary rate from a statutory requirement to the Board of Supervisors, where the Board of Supervisors is now
a charter. It was in the charter.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so, you know, before a ballot initiative would need to happen to move the rate. Now the Board of Supervisors can set the rate. Now it set it at 25% at first, but it also set up this process where experts would say, well, what should the rate really be? And what they've come up with is, well, there are different rates depending whether it's rental or whether it's for ownership. But here's the thing that's the real problem. So they came in under 25%. They came up with a range. What is it for rentals? 14 to 18%.
Yeah.
I believe was the range.
17 to 20 for condo.
Yeah, 17 to 20 for ownership. But what they're planning out though is, so as part of the modeling that they did, they're like, okay, so how does this play out over the next 15 years? They assumed that the trends of the past 15 years will be the trends of the future 15 years. So they're baking into their model, they're assuming a 3% real rental and price appreciation rate. Now, this is not including inflation. This is a real rate. And in doing so, they're going to justify a 0.5% bump for inclusionary each year going forward. So what does that mean at the end of the 15-year model? Well, in today's dollars, that would mean a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco would be $5,500 a month.
In what, 15 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not inflation adjusted. This is these are constant dollars.
But, you know, to play the devil's advocate, isn't it standard modeling practice to use the past historic numbers as a predictor of the future, the best that you have?
But they could have used 50 years.
Well, no, right? Well, it's really hard to model it like 50 years. But I mean, like, so like 50 years. So Tim, yes, you're right. Here's the thing, though. It's been a fucking disaster, San Francisco housing policy, for the past 40 plus years.
They also don't have to raise, right? There's nothing saying that they have to increase the inclusionary.
And they could peg it to something. Right. They could peg it to an objective measure. They could say, we'll raise it when X happens. Yeah. They don't have to have
That's the point, a steady march.
Yeah. They don't need to do that. You're right. But these are the recommendations that are coming out of the committee. And, you know, so while, you know, Tim is correct, these have been the past rates. Well, What have these rates done? So I'm now displaced from the mission.
Yeah.
When I was going from Martinez for the Lafayette court case to Sacramento just yesterday, train wasn't fast enough. We had to take a Lyft. Our Lyft driver used to live right on Mission Street in Bernal Heights. He's now living in Concord. This is what San Francisco housing policy has done. And it is not normal to have 3% real appreciation rates. This is like the definition of failure. And we have policymakers that are trying to turn San Francisco into Monaco, with the only other city that has a really high inclusionary rate on earth that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is all totally true. I mean, it was really interesting to hear the guy who was there representing the TAC come up there and say, we see no indicators that San Francisco is going... So there was like, oh, but we've... It was really funny because Dennis Richards was putting out this being like, hey, but we've permitted all this housing and it's all going to come online. And the guy from the TAC was like, yeah, that's probably not going to make much of a difference. I don't know. I can look up his name. Yeah.
You know, there's a bunch of politicians that said they take 25 like out of the air.
Yeah.
Like Todd Oberling did a poll.
It sounds
like
good. It's a nice
round
number.
Yeah, 25 is a nice quarter number. And like, I think when the advisory committee, you know, when they saw that it wasn't going to be 25, I think the increase is, you know, something that they threw in to kind of cover themselves. Like, it eventually could get there.
I guess, you know, one of the things that I'm not sure I get is, you know, the argument about future prices, which is a pig in a poke. No one knows what they're going to be. We least of all. And prices in the end are just a symptom of what the supply is. And you know, I'm not sure how productive it is to focus on prices as opposed to housing production. And going back to the TAC, the thing that truly alarms me is that it's not clear if the TAC is a fig leaf concocted by the authors of Prop C to grant legitimacy. The idea of the TAC was to figure out, is housing going to become economically infeasible under these new rates? And there's nothing in Prop C that says the supervisors have to follow the TAC recommendations. And they're politically boxed into a corner that says 25% is the right rate, and here are these eggheads telling them, well, maybe it's 14. What is the likelihood that they're going to adopt 14?
Yeah.
So that's a great point, Tim. But right, it's not just eggheads. Like, the TAC like had plenty of people who were definitely not eggheads.
Yeah, they're members of
ours. Yeah. Well, and there were some members of yours from SFAC.
And I call them eggheads.
And, well, there I would dispute that characterization. And then there are folks from the so-called affordable housing world, and their only concern is who is going to be living in my units, who is going to be living in subsidized units. They don't care what the market rate does, that they've totally written that off. And, you know, I would push back, Tim, to this idea that we shouldn't be looking at price forecasting. Like, what does the Federal Reserve do? They're looking at inflation rates, they're looking at employment rates, and, like, based on that kind of targeting, they're setting their monetary policy. San Francisco could set a policy for price stability. Now, I'd appreciate this in nominal dollars. Set a target saying, we don't want rents to go above a certain amount. We don't want home prices to go above a certain amount. The way to make that happen is to approve sufficient numbers of apartment
yes.
units and condo units
yeah.
in order to make that happen. And they didn't consider this at all. When I spoke with members of the planning department about this, they're like, oh, yeah, huh?
I mean,
oh, that's interesting.
We have, what, 30,000 units? There's a lot of units that are permitted or coming on.
There are a lot of units permitted or coming on.
I
mean,
I didn't
but
know
the
TAC
was the first people to admit that there was it was very unlikely that we would continue that trend.
Take that 30 or 40,000 pipeline unit number with a barrel of salt.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, a lot of those are like Treasure Island units, and there's Strike Lock, which isn't yet done. And
26,000 units in Treasure Island, Park Merced, and Hunter's Point, and the rest. You know, I think this thing that much is made of at these hearings of, oh, we've got, look at all of these units in the pipeline. And, you know, I love the planning department folks as much as anybody, but I think a lot of that is their justification for their job. See, we're doing our job. We're permitting all these units. And the pipeline is robust, and it has nothing to do with whether they'll be delivered to market.
If they can get financing for it, then yeah.
Well, and I will say that the biggest hindrance to them getting the financing and whatnot is the level of insecurity mm-hmm. and the level of how long it takes to get through that freaking pipeline. By the time you pop out the other end of the pipeline and maybe get your permits, years have passed. Market conditions are completely different. The best thing we could do to ensure that those projects actually get built as proposed is shorten the permitting time. I mean, and Sam, I know you've got a project that's like, you know, was supposed to be expedited through the process, and
yeah.
that is turning out to be not at all.
Yeah, because we're building 160 units at 1950 Mission. And it's two zoning, no density bonus or anything. And there was the legislation last year, I think.
Yeah,
that was to expedite 100% affordable housing. But
thank you, Scott Wiener.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Scott Wiener. But, I mean, it's still taken almost 7 months from when we submitted till when planning was just ready to give us comments.
Yeah.
I think we're going to help fix that process. We passed legislation that said expedite, but, you know, planning is... As Tim said, like, I love them as much as anybody, but they do need, like, rigid instructions about how to do things, and taking out just, you know, the DR, taking out the fact that we used to have to go to the Planning Commission to get our final stuff has thrown them for a loop a little bit, and so we're just, like, the first guinea pig. I hope it'll get shortened, but it has not been, it doesn't feel expedited.
Yeah, so, Laura, just to comment on what you said, like, you're exactly right that the uncertainty of the entire process and the length of time really are major cost drivers of housing in San Francisco. But it's also the exactions and the conditions that, like, San Francisco levels on any new development. But the fact that we're talking about right now, like, $100,000 a door and various fees, whether you're talking about housing impact fees or inclusionary requirements or sewage hookup or schools or parks or, like, whatever, that means that, you know, housing, like, the only types of housing that pencil for developers to be profitable is very expensive housing. This is why this is like one of the reasons why in San Francisco, I mean, Tim, like, what are we looking at now? $1,200 a square foot for new construction? Like, it's insane.
Yeah.
Miami's $300 a square foot.
Yeah, like, but I'm not sure you can put the construction costs on our bullshit, you know, public process that puts so much cost on it. That's a different economic area.
Like, my understanding is that, so at least the person who was explaining that to me said that was factoring in, like, everything. Like, their cost of construction of the buildings they were building total factored in $1,200 a square foot. But, like, the idea that, like, look, if it's four times as expensive to get housing built in San Francisco than it is in Miami,
but like
where does Miami, that leave low and middle income people?
It leaves them driving cabs
in Concord.
And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting to see, though, the housing market in the city right now, because it seems agreed that rental prices have peaked and they're falling slightly. They're not going to crash. They're not going to become cheap. But they're falling, and ditto with condo prices have fallen off. Inventory climbed a bit, which is saying the same thing. And what that, the likely cause of that was a kind of a nice slug of housing that came through the pipeline in the last two or three years, not just through the pipeline, but delivered to the marketplace. What was conspicuously absent in that whole time was any smaller scale, lower cost construction in the neighborhoods outside of the urban core, the cheaper stuff that's intrinsically more affordable to people. We're not building that. And what that means is that we skew the market to the high end with all of the insane process and fees we tack onto housing.
So talking with planning about the Central SoMa plan, that was like, it's interesting how these things all end up fitting together, because for the Central SoMa plan, they're planning on allowing the plan to allow for like 75,000 new jobs, and
half of that housing, right?
No, like a tenth of it housing. It's like
7,000. But it's a big imbalance.
Massive imbalance, and like, their argument is, well, it's the last place we can build jobs. And I'm like, well,
slash housing or offices, the thing that gives us more tax space.
And it's the last place you can build jobs if you assume that the West Side and the South Side shall never be touched.
And that's a problem. We need doing that. We need to start looking at the West Side for everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it assumes that, like,
wait
and
a minute.
It also.
I live
I'm coming through your neighborhood.
Yeah, Tim.
And it assumes that we are not an integrated Bay Area where the South Bay isn't going to be adding jobs for the next 20 years. I mean, it's
two thirds of the city.
Or Oakland, which gets none of this tax revenue.
And
it
assumes that jobs means a specific thing, which is office jobs. It doesn't mean retail and, like, sort of
a lot of the things. With you, but I've made peace with the Central SoMa plan. You know, we got involved many years ago when it was first, the articulation of the ideas behind it, and we sort of, threw ourselves at it and saying more housing, more housing, more housing, but have come to accept the argument. Yes, if you look at, we saw the zoning maps and where it is possible to build dense office place for the jobs, and there wasn't that much. We haven't given up entirely that jobs housing balance has to be foremost in what you think, but we accept that they're trying to find places to put housing in Central SoMa.
Have we not hit a critical mass in San Francisco with office?
Well, no, we haven't. And we know that based on the vacancy rates and based on the prices. But, like, you know, so as...
We just gave Lennar like a huge... waiver. Like, they're going to build a ton of housing down at Hunters Point and pay for the infrastructure to do it. And, Lennar has never
gone back on their word
in any city.
Looking at the beauty contest for office space, that's going to come. There's a desperate shortage of office space.
So as listeners of this podcast must know, I have strong opinions about a great many things. I don't have very strong opinions about the Central SoMa plan in that, one, the idea, a jobs housing balance, you really need to look at this at a larger scale than, like, part of a neighborhood.
Which is why,
like, given Trans Bay Terminal, like, given everything else, like, it does make a lot of sense to site a lot of office jobs there. That said, if we're not building housing, and Laura, you've been a very firm advocate of building more housing in the West Side and not having all the development fall in SoMa or Hayes Valley or Dog Patch or, like, wherever, then maybe I don't support it. Like, if San Francisco doesn't have a credible plan to build housing elsewhere, then I think it is a problem. But, I thought that Tim made a really good point earlier when he was saying, we hadn't been building the cheap types of housing. Mm-hmm.
Well,
right,
less expensive. Let's, you know, cheap.
Oh yeah, okay, like less expensive. Sure, for there, right? Because okay, if you're building steel and concrete in Soma, that's really expensive. If you're building 4-story stick, you know, construction, in the Sunset, that's still expensive in the Bay Area, but it's not that expensive.
It's just illegal.
It's just illegal. And if you look at when prices in the Bay Area really started diverging from national trends, like it was around the 70s.
We upzoned, downzoned. It's not when we upzoned the Trans Bay.
No. That's not happened. No, it was when how did like Los Angeles or Berkeley or like wherever used to deal with housing affordability? Well, they would, you know, along transit corridors, like bus corridors, single family homes would get knocked down and they would build like 6-unit or even 20-unit, you know, dingbats or like ugly cheap buildings with like, you know, first floor cars, and then you have your apartments and it's just stucco with the windows flush against the stucco.
I know, people love and those things now.
You know, and like some people do, some people don't. I kind
of
love
them. But there's a lot of nostalgia.
Right. But they're cheap. That's how you maintain affordability.
Yeah. I mean,
We've
let like 2/3 of the city think that they live in a suburb, but they enjoy a metropolis. And got to stop.
And this is why, so everyone's saying, well, we have to pass the Central Soma plan. And I'm like, sort of like, well, why? I do not understand. Okay, but the only reason we should pass the Central Soma plan is if we can tie it to another piece of legislation. Right now, there's no, it's orphan legislation. It's going to arrive at the Board of Supervisors where no one gives a shit about it. There's going to be nobody pushing it forward as like the champion of it. It should be tied to a serious upzoning of the outlying neighborhood.
So, in our world, we'd say the low-hanging fruit is Geary Boulevard.
Yeah.
The corridors.
And start with that one, because there's the widest political consensus.
Everything all at once.
Yeah. I'm coming for your single family.
Yeah,
Wait a minute.
but again, like, who's the new representative of the Richmond, Sandy Lee Feuer?
She doesn't even want buses.
Like, she's... Like, how these people are progressive blows my
fucking mind. She's the only one that said that she thinks maybe a parking lot would be, like, their neighborhood really needs a parking lot.
Did she really say that?
She did. Yeah. Oh my God. I'm going to say the Examiner. One of them interviewed the new supervisors. You know, what do you hold? What's your first?
She said,
I know I'm not going to be, she literally said, I know this isn't going to be popular, but I really think my neighborhood needs another parking lot.
You know, in her neighborhood, it actually probably would be popular. I know.
Yeah. Start with the transit corridors. Start with the NCDs, NCTs. Get rid of density controls. Get rid of parking minimums. And bring on the density bonus, either state flavor or our own ill-fated, possibly to be passed version.
But yeah. Like, I mean, that's the thing, though. The density bonus is awesome. I love it. But you don't need to upzone, you know, a great deal. You could. Do 45 feet all the way down Geary to the beach and probably like quintuple the amount of units.
Well, but you gotta remember though, right? So like if you currently have 2 stories and you're only allowing 45, like that's not gonna get developed, right?
Well,
if you get rid of density though, you can make smaller, you know, you can make units within those extra 2 floors.
Yeah, but okay, but and now like Home SF is talking about like requiring 40%, you know, 2 and 3.
I mean, and that's our requirement. The affordable housing world has to do 40% to at least 2s and 3s.
Yeah.
But they're not, I mean, the 2s are valuable, but the 3s really get blown way out of proportion.
So we should stop and say what Home SF is, because I don't think we've talked yet about
it's a really clever rebranding. Wait, Home SF, I was there, I was holding a balloon, which I think was hitting some like poor, like, you know, construction, like carpenter in the face or something, like the entire time.
Union.
Yeah.
Of course it was union. It was union labor.
Yeah.
Representing.
So, you know, the Affordable Housing Bonus Plan is San Francisco's, attempt to come into compliance with the state density bonus law, which has been on the books since 1979. Look, Katie Tang is a hero, and I don't want to take anything away from her. I really admire that. Look, this is a neighborhood that, you know, she's
a
from,
West-sider.
She knows well.
A West-sider
exactly.
stepping up on
yeah.
housing.
No, and I admire that, and her efforts should be applauded, and I think we literally did applaud Katie Tang at this Valentine's Day ceremony. And Just okay. Oh, I'm going to stop in a minute. I actually felt pretty bad because technically the first person that day I wished a happy Valentine's Day to was Ed Lee, not my girlfriend. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. That was,
political.
No, he wished it to me first. And I was like, what do I say back? Right? Like,
of course you wish the mayor happy Valentine's Day.
I mean, it's awesome that Katie's doing this, but we need to help. The density bonus. Hindsight, from last year, they rolled that out. I feel like we could have done a little bit better.
Yeah, could have done a little better. Yeah. That was a train wreck, the likes of which.
No, no.
Oh my gosh.
If you are at the point where Calvin Welch is saying that you are having ethnic cleansing and no one is checking him at all.
Wait a minute. Wait. Who in this room has not been accused of being an ethnic cleanser?
You're right.
Okay. Now, this isn't being recorded, but none of us are raising our hands right now.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that from somebody... So when the first rollout of AHBP was happening, it was when I was still in the stage where I was like, well, I've only been in this like a year or so. What do I know? Like, listen to the adults in the room. Like, they're saying come out and support this AHBP thing. Like, to me, this seems like they're politically doing some things wrong, but I'm sure they know how to play 3D chess better than I do. And then I watched it just crash and burn and then burn some more and then the gasoline was poured.
The first one has to die. The first one has to die so that maybe the second one goes through.
And I just feel the need to say, my favorite chess metaphor is 11th dimensional chess. I think it's way funnier, so I just want to put that out there.
Instruction for that?
Yeah.
But I mean, the density bonus is a really good... I mean, I truly think that people don't want to talk about the fact that the state density bonus trumps everything that we could do in the city.
Oh, like, some people do want to talk about it, and therefore maybe working to undermine the state density bonus law.
Are people doing that? Yeah,
yeah, that's a wonderful segue, Laura.
Yeah. Word on the... So we're going off
the whiteboard now. We're off topic, but it's good.
We're off topic. But well, so this fits in with we're going to Sacramento on March 6th to lobby people, and we hope that everyone will come and contact their supervisor... I mean, not supervisor. Haha. State. We'll contact their state senator and assembly.
I'll be there,
yes.
To
support pieces of legislation, and it looks like to fight against a piece of legislation that we're being told we're maybe overreacting about, but I don't think we are. Looks like a piece of legislation that is going to eviscerate the state density bonus.
AB
915. Yes. It's vague. So what's happening right now is that they introduce placeholder legislation. It's a little blurb that they do that's supposed to be to get it in so that they'll be able to
their committees and their meetings.
Yeah, exactly. And the placeholder legislation basically kind of implies...
So I'll just read it. It's one sentence long. It is the intent of the legislature to enact legislation that would authorize local governments to require an applicant for a permit for a housing development to include affordable housing units in that development without receiving a density bonus or other incentives or concessions provided pursuant to section 65915 of the government code. And for those of you who don't have every government code reference memorized, that's the reference to the density bonus law.
So a sane reading of that would be that it is saying that, hey, you can require inclusionary zoning, you can require subsidized affordable percentages without those municipalities offering the density bonus.
And it's removing the thing about the density bonus is it says you can't make rules that are so hard that they effectively stop all development, right?
Yeah.
That's really what it's removing. It's giving the Lafayettes of the world the
permission
right to just be racist bigots.
Now, again, this is just called intent. This is like an intent bill. It's one sentence long, so we don't know what the actual legislation is going to be. But what we do know is that the proponent of this legislation is a favorite of ours, Peter Cohen, who was shopping around this bullshit idea to Sacramento because he is just another rich homeowner who doesn't
Welch
want
told
new,
him to kill
you know,
the density bonus.
And Calvin Welch is $2 million upper hate place.
They want to run somebody against Katie Tang.
Yeah, so this is like a fuck you to affordable housing advocates and a fuck you to Katie Tang, and so what we're
we should specify to do. Though, it's not a fuck you to necessarily San Francisco affordable housing developers.
Yeah.
It's a fuck you to statewide affordable housing developers. Yeah. This is really, you know, San Francisco, it's going to like maybe affect a very small number of projects.
We don't build those. And we don't build the inclusionary. The market rate people build the inclusionary.
And additionally, it's not even for the people who are doing the in lieu fees, instead of building it themselves and paying it into the mayor's office on housing, it's a very small, almost non-existent source of funding for subsidized affordable housing in the city. But outside of San Francisco, in the suburbs and whatnot, where these density bonus projects are really designed to target, is where this is really going to make it so that these asshole suburbs can just raise the inclusionary percentage up an arbitrarily high percentage, knowing that it will be enough of a disincentive that they will not have to build any housing.
Which sort of gets to the intent. You know, if you consider who probably proposed it, it's that, you know,
I have it on good authority from people in a position to know that it was that asshole Peter Cohen. But continue, Tim.
So, what you're saying. And given that, be that as it may, its intent is the evil is market rate housing. That's right. The problem. If only we had the strength of character and the courage of our convictions to really lock down and curtail market rate housing, we'd be in much better shape. And that's consistent.
And we make decisions in this, or the affordable housing, I just made quote signs with my finger. The affordable housing, you know, advocates in the city, I'm learning more and more every day. Like they push things forward and they make decisions, and they, you know, they don't care about Lafayette or Walnut Creek or Millbrae. Like, they only care about San Francisco. There's a reason why y'all are the only ones going and suing Lafayette. I have personally asked all of them. Like, you know, I've even offered stuff you probably wouldn't even have agreed to, like, you know, letting them be in the mission and everything if they'll come help. And they don't care. They only care about their micro, super, hyper micro neighborhood.
Yeah. And also, though, right, so, you know, Tim, these folks advocating on behalf of the evils of micro development, it's funny that all these folks actually own condos or own single family homes that are fast appreciating. So, like, these aren't people that are living in these. But I just want to, like, be clear. So, like, when I mentioned earlier that a lot of affordable housing advocates statewide, as you know, Laura clarified, are upset about this, it's not because they're getting a piece of the pie. Like, you know, in these suburbs, it's still market rate developers who are building these density bonus units. It's the same building. But the really weird thing is, when you leave San Francisco and go to Sacramento, the affordable housing advocates there are people who've mostly dedicated their lives to improving the lives of low-income folks. And they don't have particular ideological access to grind or personal grudge. It's so unlike San Francisco. Whereas these so-called affordable housing advocates here, what are they principally concerned with?
Keeping their job. And
yeah. It's and very,
that,
very
that
different.
That stems from redevelopment. Like, we talk about it a lot. You know, the way Peter Cohen and them see things stems from redevelopment. The way it used to be like a giant affordable housing bank that flowed $1 billion a year through San Francisco.
Very
and LA.
Successfully.
Yeah, yes, agreed. Mission Housing built the majority of our buildings with redevelopment money. But, like, Sacramento, they got a much smaller piece of the pie. Like, I'm just saying that, like, the current affordable housing advocacy nonprofits, that's where it stems from. Like, you know, it's like, we need to control the money, we need to be aggressive and all that. I mean, that's what I think.
But I don't understand why. There are other sources of funding, and there are other sources of funding for subsidized affordable housing that would make a much bigger difference in actually...
Well, I mean, redevelopment doesn't exist
but you
anymore.
Could, but they should be fighting for instance, and I've said this far and wide, a hotel tax that would directly fund subsidized affordable housing. We could do that. We could increase the hotel tax, and that would be a double whammy for their base of fuck Airbnb and let's increase affordable housing funding. There are things that we could do. We could pass tax increases.
But the hotel tax is probably one of the, if not the highest in the United States, certainly one of two of the highest hotel taxes in the United States.
Yeah, it's already
I don't care about the tourists. Yeah. My mother stays on my couch. That's fine.
You're like a NIMBY tourist. You're like, I don't want people to enjoy
tourist.
My beautiful city who are living here. Okay, wait. I just want to step back for a second.
Or
you know,
sugar tax.
For those who don't know, the redevelopment was a source of funds. It was what, like $1.2 billion a year before it was killed, or somewhere around there. But look, it was killed not because, you know, Jerry Brown and the folks at Sacramento are evil and they hate low-income housing.
A little bit of that.
No. It was killed because of the housing crisis.
There's a bunch of crisis.
The revenue for California collapsed, and there are constitutional requirements because of some proposition whose number I forget that requires a certain amount of funding to be going to the schools. And so this was an effort to make this, you know, the public school system whole. And by the way, it's not whole. But like that's what this was.
I mean, it needed to happen. I mean, so I've been in Mission Housing for 5 years, or almost. I got there a month before Jerry Brown killed redevelopment. So I've never known redevelopment as far as, like, you know, getting financing and everything. And the more I learn about it, I mean, it's been hard. It's hard to pull together 7, 8, 9 sources of funding to build something when you used to just be able to go to, you know, redevelopment. But it does seem like the Band-Aid needed to get ripped off. I think our industry is inadvertently stronger for it, especially with Trump now. Who knows what's going to happen with the federal government. You know, inadvertently, I do think that we've been preparing for Trump without knowing about it for the last few years.
Yeah, that's...
I see a climate that is, I don't know, distinctly unfavorable to the affordable housing industry right now. The federal support for housing that was rock solid for decades has been dwindling.
Well, it's been dwindling for decades, though, Tim.
Yeah, it's gone down 2/3 in the last
We're at like
years.
1980s funding levels.
And it ain't coming back. Yeah. And unless Donald Trump figures out how he's going to turn on the spigot, we have less and less funding. And the state is still pulling out of the wreckage of the Great Recession, and it has massive unfunded pension and medical liabilities. Where's the funding for affordable housing?
Well, I mean, we've been
Prop 13. It's sitting in people's property taxes.
But the thing is, though, like, we've been for-profit, non-profit, or public-private partnerships for like 30 years. Since HUD started, you know, defunding over and more and more and more, the tax credit project is literally a for-profit investing in affordable housing.
The market for tax credits is, how do we say it?
It's in flux.
Pretty worried.
Yeah, so like let's be clear about like why that's happening. That isn't happening because of any specific government policy. It's that the value of a tax credit, which is how like most like very low income housing in this country is built nowadays.
Yeah.
It's going down because there's this thought that Trump and the Republican Congress are going to cut taxes. They're going to cut corporate taxes, and they're going to cut high marginal income taxes for wealthy people. And so they're not going to need these tax credits anymore. And Sam, I'm sure you have a lot more insight in this than I do, but you know what I've read and heard is that the value of these tax credits is already plummeting.
It's already happened. Yeah. I know a few developers who, and when you use tax credits and close a deal, it takes about a year of due diligence and planning. And like, I know a couple companies who shall remain nameless that got up to like a week or less before the closing, and the tax credit investor called and was like, sorry, we heard Trump's gonna, you know, do this and this and that. And they didn't kill the deal outright, but they're demanding like millions and millions of more dollars on the back end.
So let's bring this back to a local level. Disappearing of the traditional public support for subsidized housing that we used, it was solid for a long time. It's disappearing. That's, you know, it's just, that's what it is. And, you know, a city has limited resources that it can bring to bear on its own. What's so massively puzzling about this is that our adversaries at Choo Choo, you know, Calvin wrote a brilliantly worded column saying, don't give us any of this build more housing crap. I don't like it. It destabilizes neighborhoods. It makes profits for developers. Don't do that. Just give us money. We want money, meaning for subsidized housing. And the paradox is that money isn't coming. I think they're in big, big trouble. Where is the subsidy for housing?
I would go further than that, and I would say that this conversation that we're having, where we're worrying about where the money is going to come from for these subsidized affordable housing, is much more useful than all of us bickering about what exactly the percentage affordable inclusionary zoning should be. It is a waste of all of our time to be spending, having this tack and all this stuff even to begin with, because we all know that this is nowhere near the need and is certainly not going to stabilize the existing projects, which are definitely at risk.
But the thing is, though, like this like type of actual pragmatic conversation of how do we get the money to support, to build housing or to support housing vouchers or whatever, that's like low-income people live in safe, secure, and stable housing. It is happening in Sacramento right now. I mean, I was at the first housing committee meeting yesterday in Sacramento. I don't know that I'm quite at Laura Clark level, but you know, I was there, and you know, it was just straight up YIMBY gospel for hours. It was lovely because like it was folks acknowledging one look for extremely low income people. There is no YIMBY scenario that's going to provide for them in the near term. Now, because like the problems of poverty are different than the problems of a dysfunctional housing market. Now, a dysfunctional housing market exacerbates the problems of poverty, but it's not as if we just start building a lot of housing in San Francisco that like poor people are going to be okay. They're still poor, and that still sucks. So what all these expert witnesses were testifying, I mean, not quite testifying, were presenting for in the committee meeting was that we need a lot more money in order to provide housing vouchers, to build more low-income housing. What we also need to do is we need to streamline housing production. We need to get rid of some of these roadblocks. We need to build a lot more market-rate housing as well. We need to also further incent developers to build more below-market-rate housing. We need an all-of-the-above solution. And it's like, wow, this is what Sacramento's like. If only this were the conversation happening in San Francisco right now.
And everyone assumed that everyone else was like a moral person at base and didn't like question whether or not they were a worthwhile human being. Yeah, that sounds
very
lovely.
Very different.
Yeah.
Very different.
I wouldn't know how to deal with that.
Okay,
really.
Wait. So like, Tosh, so like, let's try to stay on. So again, this is a podcast, not like a video cast or whatever those are called. So you can't see our whiteboard right now. We do have some items that we want to address. We're talking about Sacramento. Let's segue into some of the bills that we're going to be supporting when the YIMBYs go to Sacramento on March 6th. So one of them is strengthening the Housing Accountability Act. So this bill is near and dear to my heart because I wrote the first draft of it and, you know, had a lot of support from quite a few folks. But it does a number of very important things. It changes how, so like for those who don't know, the Housing Accountability Act was passed way back in 1982, which is coincidentally the year of my birth, which basically states, yeah, it's been failing for 34 or 35 years.
Or California's housing policy.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. These wonky liberals have been fucking up forever. You know, it basically states that a locality may not disapprove a proposed housing development project if it complies with local zoning rules or condition its approval on lower density, unless if they make certain findings that it adversely impacts human health or safety. And maybe I don't need to go through all the things right now, but what we're trying to do is to really strengthen the act in Sacramento to give this law that's been around as long as I have been some actual teeth so that we can build some more housing.
So it's by right then, basically?
No, it's basically saying that you can have the length of your permitting be a little bit nonsensical, and there are other things they can do to fuck with housing. Like, this is not going to solve all problems. But basically it means you can't just outright reject a project if it conforms with your existing zoning for totally arbitrary reasons.
You cannot downzone like it unless it adversely affects the health, safety, and welfare of the people in the area.
Yeah, so that's like exactly right.
Good luck.
Now, you may be wondering, wow, this law sounds great. It's been around so long. Why aren't we building more housing? Well, there are so many ways to get around it or get it. So what most localities have done, like low these past 35 years, is evade it. They either never reach a decision on a housing approval, they just keep it going on and on and on. Oh, we got to go back to circulation committee. Up, oh, your TPS reports weren't documented properly. You know, and it goes on. Or they just say, oh yeah, there's the state law. Yeah, fuck you, developer. We don't care.
There's no way to.
Yeah.
No, well, and the developer doesn't want to sue because they still want to maybe build the project in that town. So, like,
to say nothing for the future projects they might want to build.
That's right. Exactly right. They don't want to get blackballed and get this bad reputation. But also, though, right? Okay, let's imagine. Let's say that I'm a developer or whatever. Same as an actual developer. Sam is a developer. You are a nonprofit developer. Let's say that Laura is Palo Alto. Sorry, Laura. Laura doesn't want to build any new housing, just redlining everywhere.
Fucking East Palo Alto.
You're not even giving water to East Palo Alto, right? Like, you are the actual worst human being, worst city on earth.
She's not?
Well, no. This is a thought experiment. So Sam wants to build some housing. So Laura might know what the state law is, but Laura's like, yeah, fuck it. Whatever, take me to court. I'm going to drag you around for 2 years of process, and then we'll go to court. And then if the judge agrees with you, and they probably will, the judge will say, tisk, Laura, you violated the law. You must now reevaluate that project in light of the requirements, and you must make specific findings. So here's the thing. Why not just break the law every time? Wait for a judge to tell you what to do. That's exactly what's happening. There is zero penalty. So one of the things that this proposal will do is it will say, one, you've got to pay your attorney's fees if you're found to violate the act for the petitioner, but also that a locality will be fined $100,000 per unit of denied housing. Oof. We need to give teeth to this law.
That's going to be an uphill climb, but I'm with you.
Yeah.
Would you take 50?
Well, I'm not going to negotiate with myself before those NIMBY assholes start trying to talk. Okay. The good news is that, so we have a bill number. It's AB678. Raul Bocanegra has agreed to sponsor it. The language on the website right now, it's just placeholder language that does almost nothing. You know, what I'm talking about is what's going to get out there. Nancy Skinner, who's a state senator in the East Bay, has agreed to co-author it. Now, look, all the stuff that we're asking for, the $100,000 per unit, increased evidentiary standard, the fact that all localities need to do an HA analysis for every pro-tillum project, and they shall not levy exactions or impose conditions that render proposed developments economically infeasible. All the stuff we're asking for, yeah, we're probably not going to get all of it. But let's start big.
Yeah.
And Raul wants to go big. Because, and this is a guy who represents a district in the San Fernando Valley. And while the issues there are different than what's going on in San Francisco, they're related. This whole state is a mess. And low and moderate income people, unless if they own their own home, are really struggling.
Like, the state really has, I mean, it's a huge state. It's the size of 3 or 4 states, right? Or everywhere else in the country. But I don't see California ever actually taking a concerted, statewide effort to look at this stuff. I mean, redevelopment existed, but it was siloed, you know? And I mean, maybe that's the one of the only good things that will come from all this mess. That California starts coordinating, LA starts talking to San Francisco and they talk to Fresno and all that stuff. Because I don't think that's ever really happened.
So that is happening right now. And I got a great reception in Sacramento yesterday where, a lot of people are actually kind of upset that, wait, why did Raul get this bill? This is such a good idea. I want my... Because, the housing crisis, while, it is most acute in certain areas, it's affecting most of this state.
All the state.
It's affecting Fresno. Fresno doesn't have this right, but Fresno has way lower wages than San Francisco does. If you look at the housing burdens, I believe Fresno is even higher than San Francisco.
No, it's not higher.
Is that
it's not. I mean, higher than San Francisco is a not the litmus test that.
Well, no, but if you look at like the actual incomes of the people who like live there, I mean, like it's incomes are much, much higher. I know that the housing burdens faced by renters is higher in Los Angeles than it is in San Francisco, even though rents are a lot lower in Los Angeles.
Well, and meanwhile, Los Angeles is considering like the worst thing I've ever heard. Prop S.
Yeah, was it Michael Weinstein? Is so. We joked about Laura being like the devil earlier if she was Palo Alto. Michael Weinstein actually is the devil.
Yeah.
He is the worst human being in California.
I don't know how he got all those famous people to sign on to it. Well, because they're
dopey. Probably he's like, an awesome party.
Yeah.
Call it a day.
Do you think there's a Scientology angle to this?
You know, I don't know. But I do know that Michael Weinstein's office... So, okay. So for this one to know. So Prop S is a Los Angeles proposition that would... basically put a moratorium on housing development if it required exemptions from the general plan. Like the problem is that Los Angeles has this
ancient... Does it even have a general plan?
Yeah, but it's like ancient. And so like every development requires a deviation.
Okay, so we didn't get to Zeitgeist, but I think we should shut down.
Yeah, I think so. We have a board meeting.
We do in 5 minutes. So...
Thank you, Laura.
Yeah, well, so okay, so let's have like any like last thoughts from Team EMB. We've got 50 minutes, we're good.
All the action's going to Sacramento. That's where it's happening.
Yeah, agreed. San Francisco needs to get organized. Yeah.
And we're there. March 6th.
March 6th. Join us. But, you know, with that, you know, keeping in mind, like, while things are happening at the state level, what that actually means is that all politics is local. And so we need people to be coming out from every municipality throughout California, really, and to be contacting. So we're going to have a list of bills that we're supporting, including the HAA one, including Scott Wiener's SB 35. We're probably going to have Filting's bill on there as a no, no, no. So this is like going to be a list of bills that we are hoping that people will contact their representatives about and track over the next couple of months because it's going to be a big year in housing. I think it was David Chu who said that this time last year there were like 20 maybe bills about housing, and now there's over 100 bills about housing being proposed. So
it's the year of housing.
All right, this is where the music comes in.
Yeah, we don't need to do that. During like that. Like, I think, come on, that's like,
at least one.
Yeah.